I have the honor of introducing our final speaker for this mini plenary, and then we'll be open for questions, so get ready for that. Dr. Ellen Riggle is a professor of political science and gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky. She is co-author of two recent books, A Positive View of LGBTQ, Embracing Identity and Cultivating Well-Being and Happy Together, Thriving as a Same-Sex Couple in Your Family, Workplace, and Community. In addition, she has published more than 60 articles in peer-reviewed social science journals, several book chapters, and is the editor of three books on LGBT policy issues. Her research focuses on policy and legal and psychosocial issues impacting the well-being of LGBT communities and same-sex couples, and she is co-director of PrismResearch.org, which I invite all of you to surf on the web later.
Thank you. I think my talk will nicely follow up what Aaron and Tonya were talking about. See, I'm getting old, so I have to take off my glasses. Where's my button? I want to set the context for my talk very briefly, just to make sure we're all speaking the same language here. Tonya and Aaron already brought up minority stress, which is a chronic stress that's experienced by people with LGBT and LGBT intersecting identities because of the stigmatization of those identities. Stigma is cultural, and it operates within a multi-level socio-ecological context that is reflected in and perpetuated by laws and policies, which is what I'll be focusing more on. And this discrimination and the sometimes less than optimal strategies that people may use to cope with stigma creates risk for poor mental and physical health and well-being. And it's important to recognize that a lot of these discriminatory laws and policies do have a disproportionately negative impact and create even greater risk for LGBT people of color. Now, in this talk, I'd like to briefly introduce some types of laws and policies that impact LGBT people. And then I'll summarize just a few of the findings from research on a couple of these laws and policies and give an example of an understudied impact that's timely. And finally, talk about a couple of proposed legal and policy changes that could create positive benefits for LGBT well-being. Oops. Now, this is a list of some of the major policy areas where discrimination is impacting the well-being of LGBT people and where positive policies either are or could be supporting health instead of creating risk. Now, given the people in this room, I know that you are all familiar with probably several of these policy areas, and I'm not pretending like this is an exhaustive list of the policies. These are just very broad, obvious areas that have numerous laws and policies within each. And I kind of made it overwhelming on purpose. And I'd like to give a couple of examples of the impact of just a few of these policies, just to point out the obvious that policy does matter. Now, first, this is now the marriage map in the United States. There are no state lines anymore. The impact of laws and debates over marriage restrictions and marriage equality on LGBT individuals and same-sex couples has been a big topic for the past couple of decades. And researchers have looked at the impact of marriage on a couple of levels. First, there have been a few studies comparing LGBT people living in states that did not recognize the marriages of same-sex couples versus those living in states that did recognize marriages of same-sex couples. And those studies have found that LGBT people in states with marriage bans or restrictions on the recognition of marriages reported, for example, and this is just some of the research, higher levels of mood disorders and more generalized anxiety, higher levels of alcohol use and psychiatric disorders, higher levels of identity concealment, and they reported experiencing more vigilance and isolation and psychological distress, and a more difficult process accepting their identity. And they also reported overall worse self-assessed health. Now, these studies have found this impact across all, most of these were just of LGB people as the targets, although transgender-identified individuals were also in these studies. But they found these impacts across all LGB people in these states, not just those in same-sex couples. So it's an impact that's from a cultural environment that supports discrimination and stigma. Now, I think a lot of people may like to think that the negative impacts have ended with marriage equality, but our research and that of scholars like Glenda Russell indicate that the impact of these state-level debates and discriminatory laws does not magically end with a change in the law. Because these events are contributors to minority stress, which is a chronic stress, and because LGBT people anticipate and expect negative future experiences based in part on their past experience, the negative impacts of a lot of these debates still continues for many people. Now, if we switch to focus on the impact of being married, and here I focus on partners in same-sex marriages, married individuals report, for example, lower levels of alcohol use than unmarried partners, lower levels of psychological distress, less depression, and more meaning, feeling supported socially, and feeling more authentic, or basically the benefits that partners in different sex married couples experience. So what we've concluded from our research is that marriage law, or that state recognition, has an impact through social messages and social supports, and more of an impact at an interpersonal level, or interactions between LGBT people and others, while the status of being married has more of an impact at that intrapersonal level, or how a person feels and how a couple interacts. Now, another area of impact is non-discrimination laws and policies that ideally include protections for sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. Now, unfortunately, I could put up, this map is not unified, right? I could put up a much more complicated map that would show a patchwork of state, local, federal, executive, institutional, workplace laws and policies that would range from no protections to very limited protections to broader statewide protections. I think it shows up in green here. The green states are the ones that have inclusive non-discrimination policies, although two of those do not include gender identity. They just cover sexual orientation. The bottom line here is that the federal law has not been amended to be inclusive, and 28 states have no protections under their state non-discrimination law. Research has found that inclusive protections are important to LGBT well-being. For example, living in a state with an inclusive non-discrimination policy is positively associated with perceiving fewer negative and more positive messages about LGB identities in the environment, their social context, higher levels of disclosure and feeling social support, lower levels of internalized homonegativity, and in research by Hatzenbuehler and his colleagues, a lower prevalence of psychiatric disorders. And by the way, it does not matter if someone knows that they're covered by a statewide policy, that those protections are included. In our research, we found that about 25% of people either said, I don't know, or they got it wrong, but the results were still the same. So what we argue is that there's a reciprocal environmental impact of these policies, where a more positive environment leads to more inclusive policies, which then sends a message that supports an increasingly positive environment. Lee Badgett and her colleagues at the Williams Institute at UCLA conducted a review of 36 studies of the impact of inclusive non-discrimination and other LGBT supportive policies in the workplace. And they found links between these policies and more openness, experiencing less discrimination, and improved health outcomes for employees. So I say this to make the point that regardless of the level of policy, these inclusive policies do matter. Now, I know many of you in the room are involved in services for youth, including LGBT youth, so I want to give a quick example of the impact of inclusive school policies. First, this map shows that 24 states have no law specifically protecting LGBT students in schools. There are some local policies and there are some federal applications of federal law to protect LGBT students and transgender students, but I think we all know how that's going. Not all of those are implemented consistently at the local level, and some are in fact being challenged in courts. Now, GLSEN has been instrumental in conducting surveys and studies of the impact of LGBT inclusive policies in schools. For example, from their 2013 report, LGBT students in schools with a GSA, Gay Straight Alliance, and inclusive curriculum were less likely to hear negative stigmatizing messages about their identity, less likely to experience victimization, less likely to feel unsafe, and more likely to feel a sense of belonging in school. And those are all good outcomes because we know that LGBT students who experience discrimination are more likely to miss school, have lower GPAs, report higher levels of depression, which are all then risk factors for other negative outcomes. And it's important here to remember that a lot of these discriminatory laws and policies, or policies in schools, have a disproportionately negative impact and are disproportionately enforced against LGBT young people of color and gender nonconforming youth. Now, I've summarized some of the research in just a couple of areas, and hopefully the trends are clear. Policy does matter. However, there are a lot of areas where there's very little research that directly documents the impact of a policy. For example, there's very little research right now directly about access to facilities laws or the so-called bathroom bills. So there are a couple of relevant studies I'll cite here. For example, Seelman found in a sample of transgender and gender nonconforming college students that being denied access to gender appropriate bathrooms or campus housing had a significant relationship to suicidality. And we know that many transgender and gender nonconforming individuals avoid going to public restrooms or locker rooms out of fear for their personal safety, and that this has serious negative health consequences. And looking across several survey studies, we find that over two-thirds of transgender and gender nonconforming adults report experiencing discrimination in public accommodations, and over half report experiencing negative physical health symptoms as a result. We know, with or without specific studies, that laws, proposed laws, and policies to restrict the appropriate access to facilities based on gender identity, and just the public debate that surrounds these proposed laws, and the use of negative stereotypes and false information in that public discourse is having a negative impact on the health and well-being of transgender, gender nonconforming, gender diverse, gender expansive, and LGBT people. So finally, what can we do to support the health and well-being of LGBT people? Pick an area. Here's the overwhelming list again. Do some research. Find out what policies are having a negative impact and what policies are being proposed that could have a positive impact. It's not enough to just get rid of negative policies. We need to proactively enact positive policies that send a supportive message and actually implement protections. You can look at the websites of any of these or numerous other LGBT rights organizations in the U.S. or globally to get more information. I'll give just a couple of quick examples. We need to repeal the laws that allow discrimination against LGBT people including the so-called religious exemption laws that specifically allow discrimination targeted at LGBT people, such as the law in Tennessee that allows mental health care providers to refuse service to LGBT people. We need to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the federal law and to all state non-discrimination laws so that somebody does not get married on Sunday and fired on Monday, which is still possible in 28 states, or come to a job interview dressed in gender-appropriate clothing and not get hired for that reason. Until we get the federal and state laws passed, we need to repeal state laws that prevent local jurisdictions from including sexual orientation and gender identity in their local non-discrimination ordinances. Bills such as HB 2 in North Carolina, which everybody thinks of as a bathroom bill, actually includes a provision that prevents cities like Charlotte from including sexual orientation and gender identity in their local non-discrimination policies. And those, remember, level does not matter, it's the message. We need to fill in the U.S. map for supportive school policies for LGBT students, and we need more assistance for homeless and at-risk LGBT youth, and that is just in the U.S. context. Unfortunately, there's a lot of work to do in the U.S. and globally. But policy does matter, and it has an impact on LGBT well-being. Thank you.
Great. I hope people have some questions. And as you're moving towards the microphones, I just want to remind you that it would be great if you could introduce yourself and tell us where you're from before you fire off with your question. Okay, great. Let's
Hi.
Start over here on your right.
Thank you.
On my right.
I'm Sophie Mead. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm working as a program coordinator on a research program at Johns Hopkins University. And as somebody who's really interested in pursuing a clinical career in trans-competent care, I'm really interested in what you guys were all talking about with the paradigms that we use to address sex and gender, and specifically Dr. Jansen talking about the way that the medical community has a lot to apologize for specifically. And I think in addressing that, I'm interested in the way that even with things that are sort of envelope pushing and the way we talk about trans and gender identities, they still sort of fall back on this paradigm of male-female sex identity. And so the idea of like transgender gender identity occurs sometime in childhood versus like just all gender identity occurs sometime in childhood. Or cisgender is the state of being not trans versus cisgender is the state of just having your gender identity conveniently correspond to your assigned sex. And so in thinking about the way that we can shift those paradigms to further legitimize trans identity as equivalent to a cisgender identity, I'm interested in what all of you think about what the role of clinical practitioners and physicians can be in their field to sort of push those boundaries, like where those sort of sites of intervention can take place, because I get that it's a slow process, but I'm interested in hearing what you think.
That's a great question. To me, the thought that pops into my head is the concept of structural competency. We're moving away in medicine of this idea of culturally competent care, this idea that we can know everything about every community. But instead, how do we understand the structures that are in place that make those barriers present and sustained? And when we're talking about trans folks in particular, there's a tremendous number of barriers just for accessing care, not to mention to be on this side of the presentation, right? There's not a lot of trans people who are in medicine. And what I would say is kind of the most effective way we have found, at least at our institution, to get policies enacted is to get people in the room. We have to apologize as a medical field because we kind of put our own ideas onto multiple different kinds of communities without inviting those communities into the room. And so having trans people be able to tell their own stories and educate us and be involved in research design, in the clinical work, in the policy work, I think, is probably the most effective thing that you can do. It's a lot easier to kind of push folks away when you don't actually have them in the room with you hearing their stories. So that's what I would say.
Hello, Baltimore. Good to see you here. And I would love to see you in Baltimore and have a conversation, because I think specifically at Johns Hopkins, there are really important things we need to do. Johns Hopkins has a millennial worth of things to apologize for to a whole lot of communities. And you are probably familiar with a very well-established psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins that recently published a very non-scientific report. And there are a group of people organizing on campus around a response to that, so I encourage you to do that. I have lots of other thoughts about what you said, but I know other people have questions. But I recommend that we have a conversation, and that if you are able to get engaged in the activism that's happening on the campus around that, to do so.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. We're ready to take a question on the left.
Hi, good morning, or afternoon now. Thank you for the presentations. My name is Maria Angela Soto, and I work for the New York City Department of Health. And just as baseline, more work needs to be done, and I really value all of the work that you presented on. And I say that to also kind of the disclaimer, I honor and I want to honor the fluidity of just the gender experience, and my apologies for now posing a question in such binary format. I wanted your opinion on why there is more, or rather lacking, information, research, studies, everything around the trans male experience by comparison to the trans female experience. And again, my apologies for posing it in such a binary way.
I think that was directed at me. Was that? Yeah, okay. I just want to encourage us not to throw out babies with bathwaters. Just, I know that there are, people are gender expansive, but there are also people who are very committed to their current gender. Like, I'm a woman, and I want you to call me a woman, and I know that there are many trans people who feel that way. So, yeah, let's remember that too. So I don't think you actually have anything to apologize for. There are trans men, and there are trans women, and there are other people who don't identify with the binary. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And also when we talk about, I think the structural competence piece is also really important. But I also think there are some elements of just knowledge around gender that people can have that's like a piece of knowledge. It doesn't mean you know everything there is to know about trans people and their experience, but even the things that I learned something today from Aaron about youth, because I don't work with youth, and having that knowledge is really helpful. So I'm just stealing the microphone to say that. But in answer to your question, I think that one of the issues is that for trans men who choose to take testosterone and transition to a man identity, a male identity, they are frequently invisible in society. So when people see a person with a beard, they assume that that person was born male, and they don't have any further thoughts about that. Whereas for trans women who might transition, if there are things about their appearance that other people think is masculine, then they tend to be more visible, so more attention is paid there. And I also think because the data that we do have suggests that there's lower HIV prevalence, and there's not a lot of HIV-related research in that direction, because when you know a group has 22% HIV prevalence, and your data suggests that another group has 0.5% HIV prevalence, then the resources are going to go where you see the biggest need.
Excellent point. Thank you.
Answer your question.
Great.
Yes.
Let's take one more question over here.
Hi, I'm Evelyn Olansky. I'm a contractor with ICF in CDC's Division of HIV and AIDS Prevention. I was wondering if Drs. Poteet and Jansen could, or really anyone on stage, could speak to some of the analytical complications that arise, particularly with the two-step instrument. I noted, I don't think you mentioned the fact that it was check all that apply, mm-hmm. which is rather different than most gender identity instruments, and that has, of course, analytical implications that many are as unprepared for as, say, some of the options on that instrument. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of those complications and perhaps strategies to address them. Thank you.
I'm on the hot seat today. That is a really good point, and I think I'm going to probably be politically incorrect, which would not be the first time, is that I think part of the reason for the framing of those questions is for people to be able to express themselves the way that they need to on the form, right? So there's lots and lots of data that we gather, and then we slice it up in different ways. right? So depending on what your analysis is, there could be a whole analysis on the different interactions of ways that people identify their gender compared to their sex assigned at birth, and that's a whole, I could see several papers coming out of that. And then there are questions around sex assigned at birth and any movement away from that, that could be a separate analysis. And then you could do a binary analysis if you live in the land of binary analysis. So I think it's complicated with benefit. I think it provides opportunities to do multiple types of analysis where you take the information that you have and then you slice it in different ways. It may or may not be the way that people who answered the question would want you to slice it, but that can provide really helpful and useful information. Did that answer your...
Yes, thank you.
And I'll use this as an opportunity to steal the mic, call for action. Imagine kind of yourself as somebody who is transgender going into the medical offices that you're going into. When we talk about structural competency, those kind of the fact that those two-step questions exist already is creating an environment that makes folks feel much safer about being able to disclose important truths about their identity. So the next time you go to any kind of physician's office, look at the intake forms, and if you don't see that there is an option for you to identify yourself honestly and authentically, please say something, because nothing's going to change until we all start saying that this is a priority.
Cheers to that. And with that, I think it's a great way to end this session. For all of those of you in the audience who are too shy to stand in front of mics and ask questions, I'm sure some of the speakers may have some time afterwards. And I want to thank my co-moderator and the three excellent panelists we had today. It was just wonderful to bring this to everybody's attention at this meeting. Thank you very much.